Well, good morning, Tucson. This is not Ted Maxwell. As Matt mentioned, this is Ben Bueller Garcia, normally the host of American Warrior Radio, heard Saturdays at noon here on KVOI, sitting in for the vacationing Ted Maxwell. But, you know, think about Ted, Matt. His brain never stops. So
it's true.
He can never actually take a vacation. He's probably dreaming up something or looking for other good ideas out there no matter where
he goes.
He's
smart enough to get out of Tucson once the triple-digit temperatures set in.
You know, it's funny you mention that, Matt, because I'm not a morning show guy. I'm just not. But, I mean, I'm happy to sit in, and it's cool to be able to do radio. But this time of year, it is really nice to be out early in the morning.
You are not kidding.
It's cooler. It's just the community has a different vibe out there. You know, I stopped by Circle K to get my cup of coffee, decaf, please. And, you know, all the other folks in there, you know, are working people, you know, blue collar folks getting their coffee or, you know, a sandwich for their lunchbox or something. That just makes me feel better. I don't know why.
Absolutely. It's the best time of the day as far as I'm concerned.
Now, yeah. I will share the downside of morning drive. You know, okay, better than I do, but so I get up bright and early. I'm checking the news to see what's topical that we can share this morning as we're getting ready to roll into our guests here. And when there's no new news out there, how do you deal with that, Matt? I mean, I mean, you know, LA's burning again.
Greta Thunberg, I'm still not sure if they're protesting something or one of their sports teams won a national championship. It's one or the other.
It's hard to tell.
That's when it burns.
So, you know, Greta Thunberg is lecturing the adults in the room again.
How dare you? Yes.
The Cats are in the College World Series again. What's new out there? Have you been following
Thunberg? The Cats in the World Series.
Have you been?
You're following? The only morning show host that would tie in Circle K. I'll tie all these three things together. I love it.
Have you been following the adventures of Greta?
Well, I did see that Hamas offered an unconditional ceasefire if she would leave.
Well, her ship was boarded by the Israelis, and they were taken into custody, and the ship was taken into port. So I found it interesting, you know.
She's doing pirate radio over there. I was aware she was there, and the Babylon Bee had some fun with it. But I don't. She was on a. Was she departing, or was she just hanging out offshore?
No, they loaded a sailing ship, and that's something else that caused your radar to go off. So they've got a, because she's a climate activist,
of course,
climate whatever. So they get a sailing ship, but it looks like they were running the diesel engines the whole way. You know, they never raise the sails. I guess they're in a hurry or something. But then the idea was to deliver, you know, aid to the folks there in Gaza.
Okay.
And once the Israelis boarded the ship, they found maybe a truckload worth of stuff, not.
And what's more green than diesel smoke belching out, right?
Now, I do have...
I thought maybe she was running a pirate radio station or something.
That'd be kind of, yeah. Greta and her merry band of pirates, but... I do have some advice for Greta if she's willing to take it.
Okay.
If they do confiscate your cell phone and offer you a new one, do not accept it.
Nor a pager.
No.
Especially a pager. No. That's good advice, Ben Bueller Garcia. That is very, very sage advice.
I'm just here to help out. So, Matt, the Chanticleers.
The Chanticleers.
It sounds like a 60s.
A literary rooster or something.
It sounds like a 60s music group.
It does. You're right. The soulful sounds of the Chanticleers. Yes, sir. They are the... I was kind of curious about this. Why would you pull... Of all the names you could pull out of a hat, why that, right? And apparently, if you don't mind indulging me... Coastal Carolina was previously a branch of the University of South Carolina, who are the Gamecocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted a twist, but they wanted to class it up and make it a literary kind of thing, which was the Chanticleer is something from Chaucer. Chaucer.
Oh, my.
Yes. The Canterbury Tales. So Nun's Priest Tale, where Chanticleer is a proud, clever rooster. So it's like ASU and U of A, like one has to say, well, we're educated and you're not. You guys are just a bunch of Neanderthals fighting, you know, fighting roosters. We're the erudite birds. Yes.
It's not my first language, but I'm proud of you throwing that out there. So basically they're saying that USC are just their mascot's just a brawler, whereas we're a thinking bird.
Right, right.
Okay.
So they're the ones going to the football games and the NASCAR races and all this stuff. And the thinking birds, they're pondering. They're pondering life along coastal Carolina, and they're smart.
Well, they're
good at baseball. They won the national championship in 2016.
I was
against the Cats.
Unfortunately, you had something up there about what they've got a streak of like 23 wins or something like this.
So the longest active winning streak in college baseball.
I'd never heard of these guys, and when I saw it, I thought, well, this is going to be a walk, but then. Apparently not. And, you know, that's the thing I like about the College World Series. I say more so even than, you know, the basketball tournament. You do get these teams that would normally not get a lot of national visibility. But
Murray State.
Yeah, but they're competitors, you know. And it's all, yeah. I wonder if Tucson could steal the College World Series, but with 101 degrees outside, we'd probably
they'd have to move not a good to November, which might kind of screw up all the scheduling.
Yeah, not a good candidate for that. But I'm still holding out hope that we might get some of the, steal some of the major leagues back down from Phoenix for spring training.
Do you think that's real? I think that's a tough sell at this point. They've got really nice stadiums. Ben, I'm telling you, I'm hopeful. I echo your hopefulness. It would be really nice.
This might be a subject for Tom Moulton's show, but I mean, what I'm hearing is some of the teams up there feel like they may have become the victims of their own success because there are so many and it is so crowded up there.
Really? Okay, this is enlightening.
You know, maybe. And certainly we've got good facilities down here, but I don't know. I do know because I worked on, you know, trying to save those three teams when they were here before,
yeah.
Matt, and I know the drive was an issue. Some of those professional ball players are just not up to, you know, for a 90-minute bus ride.
Right.
But,
and then a delay once you cross the Gila River to the inevitable delay between, the Gila River and the 202.
Ah.
The inevitable backup. Yes. But now that's going to be three lanes all the way. So at some point in the near future.
So I've been in Tucson since 1979, and that freeway's been under construction since then. So I'm I'm normally the optimist.
It used to be a pretty quiet drive. You know, if you think, I mean, I'm going back, 20, 30 years, but I mean, boring a little bit. But it used to be a boring, uneventful drive, punctuated by a potential thunderstorm or dust storm. That was the big deal.
You know, normally if I'm going to anything on the east side of the valley, I like going up through Florence.
It's not bad. It adds a few minutes, but it's not a bad drive. You're not constantly, having people zoom up on you and. The million trucks, and thank you truckers for getting all the goods and services where we need, when we need them. We appreciate you, but it does make the drive a little less fun.
Well, there is a shameless plug here. There's a little family owned market in Superior, Arizona.
Do tell.
Called Hings, and they have made the best chorizo ever. So for me, it's worth the drive.
Yeah.
To Superior to pick up a couple pounds of that good Hings chorizo, yeah.
So the last couple times we've gone up to the valley, we have ducked through Oracle and up that way, and it does add a little bit of time, but it's a pleasant trip, I must admit.
Yeah, and there's some historical stuff you can see
there
in Florence.
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aren't we supposed to be talking about civics this
morning? It's a neat side trip. Well, Florence is an all-American city with an all-American prison or something. I don't know, but...
Yeah,
which makes it even more American. Don't pick up hitchhikers in Florence, by the way.
Why not? It's
your second public tip.
Oh, I'd heard, though, that actually living in a prison town is the safest place to be because normally the escape convicts want to get out of Dodge.
They want to get as far out.
Yeah, but who knows? I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, the Tyson gang, they didn't stop in Florence, did they? So there may be some merit to what you say.
So I tell you what, folks, coming
and people
up,
there are probably armed because they live near a prison.
Yeah.
So
coming up, we've got just a really jam-packed all-star cast at 7:30. House Majority Speaker Michael Carbone is going to be joining us, and then we'll transition to Jaime Molera from Molera Alvarez, who's one of the best lobbyists working the legislature up there. And then very proud to also have State Treasurer Kimberly Yee joining us here on The Morning Voice. So you want to stick around. Going to be very, very educational. So please stick around and listen to us. And Matt, how do we do this? Do we take a break now, or do we
If you'd like to, we'd be happy to do that. We got to break out the BBG playlist.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Some horns, baby.
Still a young man.
Yes, sir. Tower of Power.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Buehler-Garcia, Matt Neely sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Buehler-Garcia, BBG, sitting in for Ted Maxwell.
Matt, that is not for L.A.
I was just going to say that.
I did not play that for L.A.
So if you don't know, years ago, maybe, or a while ago when I was on previously, Matt asked me to put together a playlist of my favorite songs. And being a radio guy, I always think in terms of that, you know, that first 15 seconds of the song. Is it going to get your attention, going to drive you? So that's one. But, yeah, perhaps maybe not the best timing. This morning, Mr. Neely.
Sorry.
It's okay. Fair enough. And by the way, speaking of traffic, ladies and gentlemen, if you commute or travel throughout Tucson, just if you haven't already learned to your own concern, disgust, you know, avoid 6th Street between Campbell and I think it's Alvernon, Matt. It's all being torn up. It's the tyranny of the bicycle is coming for that area of town. That's going from two lanes both directions to now one lane. Each direction. So
I'm just wondering how, like, Waze, the app Waze, is working in LA where they reroute you around traffic jams. We need you to pull off now due to the burning fleet of Waymo vehicles. We need you to detour to this street.
I tell you, one thing that gets me hot under the collar, and I'm not an engineer by any means, but if you're doing construction on one street going east-west, why do you have to do construction at the same time on the next street over going east-west? Or, you know, there's no way. It's like, can't you time this so at least we have one route we can use? I mean, yeah, okay, anyway. Well, so we were talking a little bit about the lovely town of Florence. You were mostly, but thanks to our lovely Morning Voice callers, we've got Bill has got some additional information for folks looking to maybe take a day trip. Bill, what, you know, share the glories of Florence, Arizona with us, if you would.
Sure. Hey, on the way up, there's some things to do there. Betsy and I did a fam tour for TJ at Gray Line quite a few years ago, and just to do some research on what was available there. There's a Greek monastery on the way up to Florence, just off the highway, and it's pretty cool to go see. When we did it, it was self-guided tours, but they have a variety of chapels built on the grounds, and they're just gorgeous. Some ones out total stone, the other ones wood, others are some brick. I mean, it's really neat to see. When you get into Florence downtown, and I know this is, people are going to say, "Are you serious?" Downtown, they have a True Value Hardware store that is a must see. Okay, it's an old style. You think you're back in the 50s probably when you walk in there. They're modern. They got all the stuff you'd ever want, but they got a lot of stuff. So that's almost like a time warp. So it's worth doing.
Well, the downtown is historic as well, right? Because they've got the old courthouse you could tour and stuff.
Right, the courthouse is cool. The whole downtown is kind of charming in that aspect of it. Now, the courthouse was built like in the old days, like in Prescott, where they built courthouses to look like courthouses on great big chunks of ground, not these Soviet-style courthouses we build nowadays, you know, the looks of them. But that's just another story. The Pinal County Museum there is worth a gander. I mean, there's some interesting things in there. There's a little ghoulish, but there's a collection of hanging ropes that they've used in the years past that from the prison. You can take and they do have an electric chair, I think, sitting in there, but I don't think it's plugged in.
Who's the guy that collects the hanging ropes? That's what I want to know. What were they thinking? I
don't have a clue, but, you know, it's like seashells. Why, you know? Yeah,
I don't know if it's still there, but they used to also have, though, a little place next to the prison there where you could go in and buy some of the stuff made by the prisoners.
Yeah,
kind of like a gift shop, if you will.
Sharp spoons.
They used to make purses out of license plates and stuff like that. I mean, it's been years since I went in that area there, but they were closed the one time we went up there. But, yeah, they used to do that, and they still may after they may have resurrected it. But, yeah, the downtown, I'm trying to think if there was something else in that spot. that there's three or four things you can do as on your, you know, you can do all these things on your way to Phoenix. So right. It's not like it's, you have to do a whole day trip. It's just kind of there, spend a couple hours, have some fun. And
That's Bill. The one thing I love about Southern Arizona, particularly this time of year. And I do briefings for all the new arrivals out at Davis Monthan, kind of a welcome to Tucson thing. And always make sure to highlight day trips. You know, if you're curious about, you know, Western history, you know, Tombstone is just south of us, the famous town of Tombstone. You know, Bisbee is a very cool place to visit. You don't even have to go that far this time of year, you know, with the staycations that are available. I mean, you know, for a couple $100, you can get a weekend at a nice resort and just pack an overnight bag. You know, you don't even have to feed the cats.
Yeah, and if you want to experience the Wild West, all you got to do is just go downtown Tucson about midnight.
Oh, well, but you know, also, I just saw, this is very cool. Matt might
even
like
this.
That's
what the tax is for.
Oh, shoot, what's it called? The place out, the movie set out by Bisbee.
Oh, yeah.
Mescal.
Sure.
Tom talks about that on Thursdays quite a bit.
Yeah, they're opening that up this summer for guided tours of Mescal. So if you ever want to, you know, walk where Clint Eastwood and Paul Newman walked, that's an honest to goodness, over 100 movies made there.
Interesting thing about that, too, is there used to be a lot more buildings, but when they built those buildings, they built them as like a movie set. They didn't put a really good, you know, solid foundation in. So a lot of those buildings are just blown over. So I would say if you're interested in doing that, go out there and do it before it all just turns to rubble, you know. But I don't know if anybody's putting any money in it.
Yeah, I think Tom's talked about it with his guests on Thursdays and when he talks about attractions and tourism. And they have kind of both shored up some of the structures there, yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a good thing. All right, guys. Well, right, anyways, trip my trigger. See you guys.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for calling, Bill.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Lots of information out there, Matt.
I'm telling you.
I will say there's something that I, and again, this is, I'm doing everybody else's show here, not Ted's. This is probably Grant's show, but I did see in the news this morning, unfortunately, it appears that, well, definitely Maynard's downtown is closing for the summer.
I hadn't seen that.
And they said they may not reopen.
Yeah, okay.
Apparently, they've just been bleeding cash down there after the pandemic. And I worked with Richard and Shauna Osseron. They're also the owner of the Hotel Congress down there. Just good, genuine folks. Some of the original, you know, downtown advocates when I was working on the Fox Theater, they were, you know, definitely real allies in that effort. So it breaks my heart.
They've had quite a run, Ben. And I mean, you know, they made a few headlines when they first opened it up. But I gotta give them credit, man. I mean, they've had they were like the first, you know, news making restaurant as part. It seems to me as part of the whole Rio Nuevo thing. So they, you know, good on them. They've had quite a run
and a fun location. You know, it's always kind of cool to be there by the railroad tracks.
Train goes by,
and watch things go by. So,
nice brunch there. Yeah, it's
and luckily, I think they moved basically most of their employees over to Hotel Congress. So luckily, those folks won't take a hit. But just very sad news for downtown Tucson.
Thanks
one,
for
one of the original
passing
greats,
that along.
Potentially not coming back. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. So again, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell this morning. We've got a great list of guests coming up. After the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking with House Majority Leader Speaker Michael Carbone, and then Jaime Molera, one of the best lobbyists up there in Phoenix, very much in tune with the pulse up there at the Capitol. And then we've also got Arizona Treasurer Kimberly Lee Yee coming up. So a great lineup, Matt Lely. This is kind of good news.
I'm telling you, you know, we'll be the best informed listeners in Southern Arizona, maybe all of Arizona.
Well, and that's the whole point of this show. And I encourage people to spread the word about it because, you know, I tell you, when I was running for city council both times, I'd have people come up and, you know, jab their finger in my chest and start complaining about something. And I ask them, I say, are you registered to vote? Well, no. Well, then I'm sorry. I don't have, you know, if you can't just take the time to do that basic civic responsibility, I'm sorry. I don't have time for you. It's, you know, I mean, it's not that difficult, but it is very, very important. And we do have, of course, a special election for CD7 coming up this summer.
And you can watch the Democratic, or you can listen to the Democratic debate tonight.
There's apparently something interesting going on out there. I noticed one of the candidate signs when I was driving to the studio this morning was in the ground upside down.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that's, you know, the artwork on the sign sort of replicates the U.S. flag. Oh. So I don't know if somebody was sending a political message that they don't like the candidate or they're sending a distress signal. I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and find out.
Don't know. Hey, a little Sly Stone in honor of Sly, who passed away.
He just passed away, yeah. Big part of my growing up.
82. Remember Who You Are. Featured in a WKRP episode long, long ago. I always remember this song. Rest in peace, Sly, and great show coming up. Stay tuned after the news. Got some great guests coming up. Michael Carbone next, the House Majority, the House Speaker. Morning Voice will be right back.
Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell, one of my favorite bumper tracks right there. Thank you, Chuck Mangione. Kids nowadays probably don't even remember Chuck Mangione.
This is a great, great track.
Yeah, great.
And you played this on the field with the Arizona U of A marching band. Is this correct?
Ages ago, yeah. That was back when Button Salmon was still the quarterback. Look it up, folks. U of A reference. Hey, Matt, we've got a real privilege this morning to be speaking with Arizona House Majority Leader Michael Carbone. Michael was elected to represent District 25 in 2022, not 1922. He's not that old. Leader Carbone, welcome to the Morning Voice. We're real privileged to have you here.
Hey, yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. Good morning, Ben.
So real quick, sir, my grandpa served in the South Dakota Senate and House for 25 years, and he was a farmer. And I remember one time he told me, he says, you know, a lot of people like to eat sausage, but they don't necessarily want to know how it's made. So legislation is kind of similar, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a lot like that, actually. And if you knew how it was made, you might reconsider how it was made, but yeah.
So tell us, educate us, what is your, as a majority leader, what is your role in civilian terms that folks would understand?
Well, there's a couple roles. The first and foremost is my job is one to protect our members, our caucus. I represent the Republican caucus as we are in the majority of 33 members out of 60. And, you know, but the day-to-day operations, when we're doing our floor work, someone has to manage the floor. And so that's one of the key roles I have is managing that floor, making sure everyone's, you know, everything's moving smoothly, that movement, that motion's going. Then you have obviously a speaker, then you have a majority whip. And the whip also, they aid some of the things I do. That's what we do day to day on the floor. And then there's the backdoor stuff, which is, as you said, that's kind of where the sausage is made. All the different things that are going on behind the scenes, the coordination, the logistics, and then just obviously working with members, helping them, making sure that they're successful in whatever they're trying to do. You know, obviously crafting bills and creating legislation.
If I understand it, sir, the legislature is on a brief recess right now. But there's a couple things I just want to check in with you with, because a lot of folks, we make the joke about the sausage, but people need to understand that the work that you and your colleagues do, they affect every single one of us statewide eventually. So folks need to stay informed. And I think the big, if you'll pardon the Republican reference, the big elephant in the room right now is the state budget. What is the status? Are we going to have one by June 30th? What's going on with that, sir?
Yeah, well, that's our number one major role as legislators in our state here in Arizona is to have a budget. That's the only thing that we're responsible for. The legislation, all those bills that we craft, that's kind of just that's the outside, I'll just say, noise. Obviously, we want to craft and create good policies to help our residents of Arizona, but ultimately, yes, our main role, if you talk to our members, that is to create a budget. And we have to have that budget done by June 30th, no later than that. It's never in Arizona history has we ever not done that. Otherwise, we would go into what we'd call a shutdown. Mm-hmm. So I can assure that we will have, as people will tell us and speaker says, we will have a budget. So we will have a budget by June 30th. We're in that process. The speaker just called us back in. We will be coming back in tomorrow. We've been working diligently we've been working since December on our stuff, and that's been our process, a little bit different than we have in the past, a little bit of a cultural shift. But one of the key things with our budget, Ben, is the speaker, one of his visions were to make sure it was member driven. And what that means is from day one, we made sure our members were included, part of the process, very transparent. I'm speaking internally. So they knew day to day or wherever time, even week to week, whenever anything ever changed, they were abreast of that. As of yesterday, the perfect example, I came in the morning first thing at 8 o'clock, started meetings with members. By 1 o'clock, the speaker called for members to come back in. He has to do that within 48 hours to give us that leeway. And, you know, I just found, well, we got a new updated worksheet, if you will, of what that budget looks like. And we went over that together with our members. That's what we did all day yesterday.
So what are the sticking points right now, the big ones for you that you see, Michael? And is it you still need to work some things out between the House and Senate side and then also with the governor? Is this sort of a, you know, triumvirate discussion, or what are the major things that you see still need to be clarified?
Well, first of all, let's get kind of, we have three branches, the House, the Senate, and the governor. The House and Senate are controlled, those chambers are controlled by the Republicans, and then you have a Democratic governor. So we call that as a divided government. Mm-hmm. So in the process, typically, you'll see the House and Senate. Now, this is only in the last 2 years, because before that, we've had a Republican governor for the last over a decade with Ducey and then Brewer, then Napolitano. So typically, you would want to work with our Senate to come to an agreement, you know, a meeting of the minds, and then we can use that to come back to with the governor, and then we'll work out with the governor. And so you'll have that three-way play. However, we could not come to a term with our Senate colleagues, unfortunately. And you know, the speaker wants to put together a budget that's practical for Arizonans. Obviously, the key things that we've been pushing since December is public safety and then major road projects, because as the House, we feel that we've led for the last 6 months in saying, look, we don't have money. We just don't have a lot of money in the budget or in our revenues. And so we want to be pretty fiscally responsible and have a structurally balanced budget, as we call it, making sure that the revenues are there in the futures. We have uncertainty with what's going on in Washington, specifically with Medicaid, which is going to hit us hard as a state.
Okay.
But a couple more hangups is, look at, you know, the governor, she overspent $400 million. And you have to understand that it's never been done in Arizona, in the history of Arizona, as far as that much. You'll have what they call supplemental costs, things that inflate or deflate, you know, year over year that you can't predict. But that typically is, you know, in the small percentages. When we're dealing with a $400 million-plus package of over expenditures, when we agree to a budget prior year, that changes how you kind of sit down and have those talks.
I how does that even happen? We've got the state treasurer coming on later on the show, Michael, and I mean, doesn't somebody need to go to the governor and take away her checkbook? I mean, is it like taking the credit card from the teenager or what?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good point, because one of the first things I said in the meetings with our, we have, you know, staff and that, what are the consequences to that? What is she allowed to do that? Well, there is no law that says she can't. She just overspent. And so the only consequence is you have to vote. So there's that. It's a challenge when you hear that, because even when I go into my district and talk to the people, the residents and constituents in my district, they just don't understand it. And I'm like, well, I feel the same way you do, because I don't understand. However, we do have a ballot box, and that's how we take care of that. In the meantime, someone has to be responsible, you know, in making sure that our budget's sound, and try to put in the safeguards so those things don't happen. And that's difficult, because she's, you know, she might not, you know, we have to get her to agree to that type of legislation now that we want to craft.
You know, I was just thinking that it seems to me it'd be pretty easy to check other states and see what their rules are, if anybody has something, you know, and then write the legislation to that. But that's veto bait.
Well, it is. In my home, Chicago, Illinois, coming from that state 14 or 11 years ago, the most unbalanced budget in the country, there is no consequence. They just spend, right? Mm-hmm. So in the constituent or the citizens there just keep on putting the same people in. You know, here, the way to do it, though, to that point is you create legislation, which you're right. She's not going to accept that. And then I don't want to go into a hot topic, but we were in a topic with a developmental disability a few months ago. And the same thing, there was over expenditures there, what they call, again, we call those supplementals, which are over expenditures based on inflationary numbers. To try to put in guardrails, which we were able to accomplish, which we're one of 13 states that were able to do that, to say, look, before these things happen, you need to come back to the legislature and get our approval on what they call these waivers. So mm-hmm. we can try to do those things. Those are the reforms, and that's not an easy lift, especially when you are a divided government. Because I'll be honest, Republican or Democratic governor, they sometimes don't want to be handcuffed to their agencies. They want to have that liberty to do what they do with their agencies.
Yeah, fair enough. I tell you, Michael, when we come back, I'd like to talk about something that's, I know, near and dear to you. You've been a very strong advocate for housing and housing resolution. So when we come back, if you don't mind, sir, I'd like to chat about that after the break.
Yes, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen,
fantastic.
Ben Buehler-Garcia, Matt Neely sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We're speaking with House Majority Leader Michael Carbone. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Buehler-Garcia, BBG, sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We're very, very privileged to be speaking with House Majority Leader Michael Carbone. And Michael, forgive me, sir, I should have asked this right up front. I'm not really very well educated, apparently. So is it okay to call you Michael, or do I have to call you Mr. Leader? Because Mr. Leader sounds vaguely Chinese Communist Party to me. Can we just go with Michael?
Yeah, I'm pretty humble with that. That's okay.
Okay,
and I appreciate you asking those things.
Fair enough, sir. You've, as I mentioned before, you've been a real strong advocate for housing, and in my day job, I work with a number of organizations that are involved in actually, you know, building the housing. You, a huge win for you and for our industry. You were basically the author and proponent for House Bill 2447, which dealt with self-certification for architects and engineers, and that's going to significantly cut the red tape, you know, in the middle of a housing affordability crisis. We need to find every avenue we can to move these things along. So thank you for doing that.
No, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
So, sir, I don't know, this is probably part of the budget discussions, but also there's two, from my perspective, there's two critical things out there that still need to be addressed as far as the housing affordability crisis, and that's the LIHTC renewal, the low-income housing tax credits, and what's going to happen with our Department of Housing. You were talking about the governor overspending. The Department of Housing had an audit that was, let's just say, less than stellar, right?
Yeah, it's they've had serious problems there. It's actually very disappointing what we found in committee too this year, when the director had come, the official director. I guess the co-director. I don't think we were able to appoint someone, but some of the things that we found out were disturbing. And one of the key things was giving first-time home buyers a down payment assistance of $30,000. And in my whole tenure at the legislature the last now 3 years is we need homes affordable. And the question we asked is, well, does that increase supply of houses by helping home buyers? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. It's the wrong, not to say that's a bad thing, but I don't think we should be involved in it anyhow as a government. An agency, I think that should be set up somewhere else. You have HUD out of federal, Washington that does that stuff. They did get a renewal for 1 year to see if they can come into compliance by next year. The Housing Authority, unfortunately, has not been very well ran.
Do you anticipate seeing some kind of resolution for LIHTC before the end of this session, sir?
That's a great question, Ben, and it's a tough one because some of that does do support LIHTC. Mm-hmm. Coming from the out east, which we're familiar with Section 8 housing, LIHTC is a completely different form. I learned it when I moved out here; never heard of it. I know the history of it, so it's actually good policy, right? And the unfortunate thing is it's been put to set aside the wayside because as the folks up at the Capitol know and the people around the Capitol know, I'm a pretty straight shooter and I'm honest. But I said, you know, you folks, all the housing people, you need to put some pressure on the governor to fight for it, because the Speaker and the House have been fighting for a lot of things which we think are not that housing's important, but like public safety and some of the major road projects. Because even without road infrastructure, why are we even building houses if you can't have roads, right? So there's an analysis of that. And it's not a lot. I think it's like 10 or 11, maybe 12 minutes. But what we as a House, it has not been a priority from the members' perspective. And that's made it challenging because we have to categorize what's the most important.
Sure. We've got just a couple of minutes left, Michael. But the other thing, that it seems like this legislative session was the session of things expiring and needing to be looked at again. Prop 123, the constitutional amendment that was approved by voters in 2016, which provides additional state trust funds for education here in the state, that's mm-hmm. set to expire as well. And kind of walk us through that. If that's not renewed, are these monies going to have to come out of the general fund? And if it is renewed, does that still have to then go back to the voters again in 2026, sir?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, well, first of all, it does have to go back to the voters to push forward. It has expired. I think it's a little over $300 or $350 million is coming out of the general fund, which, you know, that's a backfill that comes out that we don't expect in the budget. So, but, you know, Prop 123, here's the thing. It's not going to the ballot next year, first of all. You know, outside some type of a Hail Mary that happens in the next couple of weeks. But we felt as lawmakers that, look, it is important because there's a trust fund with a lot of revenue there that helps fund education, and we want to make sure it's done properly and appropriately. So no one wants to rush to push something through. There were some things that were concerning to some of the members that were, we could not have, full 31 vote. We needed 31 out of the House. It's been put aside now the last few weeks. There's not been a lot of discussion on it, and we're probably looking at it to fight for it next year. But the key component to this Prop 123, which was different from the prior years, Ben, was that we were going to pay the teachers first. And I believe it gave to the base pay of our educators is between a $4,000 and $6,000 pay increase. The average teacher now in the state of Arizona is making, I think it's $62,000, which we've come a long way in the last 10 years where it was 10 years ago. So we've done a great job there, but we want to pay teachers even more. So,
okay.
But we want to make sure the bill's right.
Michael, we're just about out of time. I really appreciate you joining our listeners here today. And just real quick, I want to also give you a shout-out for your House Bill 2774. As a proud supporter of the USS Tucson Fast Attack Submarine, I'm thinking that maybe some of those small modular reactors would help our communities as well. So I know that didn't get out past the governor, but maybe try it again next session, sir.
Yes, we are. We're working hard, and we're not going to stop. So thank you.
Outstanding. Ladies and gentlemen, House Majority Leader Michael Carbone. When we come back, we'll be talking with Jaime Molera, the founder of Molera Alvarez, about some other things going on up there at the state legislature. Stick around.
Morning Voice will be right back after the news.
Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is not Ted Maxwell. I'm nowhere nearly as handsome or as tall as him.
Can you fly a plane?
You don't want me flying a plane. I did have a friend who let me take the stick once briefly out over Picacho Peak, but that's the limit to my flying experience. Although,
well, you didn't hit the peak, so you did a good
true.
Job.
And I do have 3,000 hours in the cockpit of an A-10 on my home computer. I blew up a lot of tanks in Iraq.
Nice.
So anyway, Ted's a great guy. I appreciate the opportunity to sit in with him. Matt, I appreciate you keeping me between the lines here. You know, you heard in the intro, folks, this is about civic engagement. And I know a lot of you don't have time necessarily to drive up to the legislature and share your thoughts. Of course, with technology today, it's real easy to find, your elected representatives' email addresses and phones. So I encourage you to continue to get engaged. And we're very, very privileged to be joined this morning by Jaime Molera. He is the founder, a partner of Molera Alvarez, one of the leading advocacy. Jaime, I won't use the word lobbyist because I know that's not polite and mixed company, but advocate at the legislature. Jaime, welcome back to the Morning Voice.
Well, great to be here, but it's also better than being called a lawyer.
Oh, very good point. So you're a lobbyist and a lawyer.
No. I said it's better than being called a lawyer.
I was going to say, that's two strikes, buddy. We don't want to do that. We just had the House Majority Leader, Michael Carbone, on the show here, and he seemed pretty confident despite the remaining divide that we are going to get a budget by June 30th. I don't think Arizona has ever missed that deadline, but, I mean, what are you seeing up there, Jaime?
Well, technically, they've never missed the deadline, but there was a couple of nights years ago where I remember they threw a cloth over the clocks so they didn't know it was past midnight. So, sometimes it can get pretty anxious when it gets to that deadline. But I would agree with the majority leader. I think that they should be able to get something put together. It's more the personalities right now. You have the differences between the Senate president and the Speaker of the House, who are Republicans, but yet, you know, there's some, I know you'll be surprised, but at the legislature, sometimes there's egos involved.
Yeah.
And the governor, who's a different party and different priorities. So there's been a lot of rumors that the Senate actually had been working closer with Governor Hobbs to put together a deal. But it looks like the House very smartly has put together their own package that they are putting out there that seems to address a lot of what the governor wants to see, what a lot of members want to see, particularly around public safety. So it'll be interesting next couple of weeks on how this plays out. But I do think at the end of the day, they should get something done.
Yeah, Jaime, is part of this debate involve the projected $207 million surplus and who gets to do what with that?
Exactly, but there's some question as to how real that surplus is, or because it's a lot of times state budgets can be very fungible. This last year, if you recall, there was a big issue in doing a supplemental for the developmental disability, which was pretty significant, and it took a lot of that money that they thought they were going to have off the table. There's also some concerns about what are the actual revenue flows. How much money was collected. So all of that is still being calculated. And a lot of this is estimates. They might have a little bit of money to play with, but really not too much.
We were just talking with Majority Leader Michael Carbone about Prop 123. And for listeners who aren't familiar with that, it was a constitutional amendment approved by voters in 2016 that would use state trust funds for directing more money to the education in our state. That's expiring at the end of this month. Majority Leader Carbone was not very optimistic, Jaime, that that was going to get addressed. And is that, when you talk about fungible, if all of a sudden we have to start backfilling those funds out of the general fund, I mean, that's a pretty big chunk of money too.
And you're right. And I didn't mention that, but it's north of $300 million. That they'll need to put in so that the K-12 budget is not cut technically. And you're right. I don't believe there's a pathway right now to get that on the ballot. I think all indications are that the Republicans would rather do this in November of 2026 at the next general election. I think there's a feeling that they want to do it, but there's two big things that are creating an obstacle. So the Republicans want to put together a 1-2-3 plan that includes not just the continuation of this interest earned for state trust lands going into K-12, but they also want to do some protections around the ESA, Education Scholarship Accounts. And those are the vouchers that a lot of folks, including Governor Hobbs, have been very critical of. And so not being able to get agreement on that, even though the Republicans want to put it out there as part of a referral, which they don't need a governor's signature, it's still a lot of tension. The governor still can block a lot of things that the Republicans want to do in other areas. So that's why I think there's a standoff right now.
Well, I don't do math in public, but we were just talking about a potential $270 million surplus, and now with Prop 123 expiring, we're talking about a $300 million hit. Guess what? There is no surplus. We're in a deficit situation now.
Well, Ben, but that's already been baked into the into the numbers. So early on, that was something that both the governor and the legislature did, just to say, okay, this money's not going to be there if we don't do it. Now, if they did end up doing it, then they would have put that money back.
I probably know the answer to this, but help me out here. Why are we always waiting till the last minute on this stuff, until Prop 123 is expiring, you know, LIHTC, the low-income housing tax credit are expiring, and that's very critical to addressing our housing affordability issue here in the state. But what? Why? Why wait? I mean, we knew when Prop 123 was voted on that, you know, there's a clock on this thing.
Right. Well, and the other thing that I'm sure is going to surprise you, there's politics involved.
egos and politics, yeah.
Even when the Republicans controlled everything, when Doug Ducey was governor and you had both legislatures controlled by the GOP, you know, there was still that tension between the governor's office and the legislature. Well, you throw in a different political party, which Katie Hobbs is, of course, as a Democrat versus the Republicans. And so you get a lot of gamesmanship that occurs. And even though we're a year away from the next gubernatorial election, I think there's a lot of jockeying right now for the policy positions, trying to make one party not look good, the other, of course, you know, look better than they should. So all of that is happening right now, and which lends itself to this paralysis that often occurs during the legislative session.
So tactically, maybe some people are thinking it's a good idea to put off Prop 123 until the same ballot when the governor's up for reelection. Just a theory on my part.
Candidly, I think there are a lot of Republicans that they're saying to themselves, well, why do we want to do this now that would give Governor Hobbs an opportunity to get credit? So I think there's some thought that they would rather wait until after even her election or at the same time, so that and the Republicans are hoping they can get their candidate in, this would continue, which would open up more money in the budget. And lo and behold, the governor can say, well, so now that we have this extra money, we can do these great and wonderful things, regardless of what it is. So it's that kind of gamesmanship that occurs.
So clearly, Hyman, what I hear you saying is there is no path forward for Prop 123 renewal, at least this session, it sounds like.
Yes, sir. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, that's too bad. There's a couple of things, Jaime, that I know Southern Arizona Leadership Council have been working on. I just want to pick your brain on, because I don't understand most of this stuff. SB 1215, which had to do with third-party litigation funding, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce actually used the in quotation fingers, that, you know, this was a national security risk. That sounds pretty serious to me.
Well, I'm not sure about national security. I'd be interested to see what their arguments are, but this is definitely a major issue for Arizona's business community. I know SALC has been at the tip of the spear in helping to push this. And really, it's fairly simple. You have these, by and large, trial attorneys. When they do these lawsuits, a lot of times against corporations, frivolous is often a term that a lot of people use. I don't say all of them are frivolous, but there's quite a bit of them. And in order to continue these lawsuits, in order to have the financing that'll pay these attorneys to be on retainer and to continue to push these legal claims, they often will utilize these loan companies, kind of shady loan companies that would go to these folks that are, you know, being talked into continuing their lawsuits, saying, hey, don't worry about it. Yeah, I know you can't afford to pay these attorney's fees, but if we get a loan for you and then we can continue this, when we win — they never talk about losing — but when we win, you'll get all this more money back. So there's a lot of folks for years. I know this has been a big issue for a lot of folks that in the business community that wanted to address this and close that loophole. So it's facing an uphill battle. I know Senator Leach has done yeoman's work in really pushing this and articulating why it needs to happen. But there's still a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle that I think it's going to be difficult to pass, but it might be part of the end game as far as the budget goes, because a lot of these more controversial bills tend to be wrapped up in those last minute horse trading that often occurs.
So Jaime, just to clarify, so this would prohibit it, and is it just these loan companies, or is it also addressing very deep-pocketed NGOs that are kind of quietly funding money into some of these lawsuits?
Yes, sir. I think it's both. I hadn't worked on this one in particular, but I know the big picture is that they're trying to close this loophole so that these frivolous lawsuits don't continue and just tend to waste a lot of time and effort and money. And also, you know, at the end of the day, these folks that utilize this, you know, they can be in a bad way because they will take out a lot of loans in order to try and continue these lawsuits.
The word payday lending is coming to mind for me. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Jaime Molera, the founder and partner of Molera. Maybe if I put the accent on, man, Molera Alvarez, better. Stick around. We'll be right back. Ben Buehler-Garcia, Matt Neely. It's the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Buehler-Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell. You know, Matt, you do that because you know the minute you put that on, my head just starts bumping here in the studio. And
give you something to pop into a break there.
That might be one of the most frequently used break songs ever. Yeah. We just need Greg Gehringer to add his voice to it and we'll be set.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know, all politics are local. I just want to remind you, when it comes to civic engagement, you do have an opportunity to voice your opinion, whatever that might be. We do have a primary election coming up for 3 of Tucson's 6 wards. Wards 3, 5, and 6 are coming up for election. Those ballots will be hitting your mailbox very soon. Please make sure you vote your preference. And just a reminder, we do have, you know, party preference in the primaries here in Tucson, but if you are an independently registered voter, you may request a ballot for either party. And 2 of those seats are open seats, so there'll definitely be some kind of change, but you want to research those candidates and get involved. We're talking with Jaime Molera. He is the founder and partner of Molera Alvarez up in Phoenix. Jaime, speaking of politics, what are you hearing about the CD7 race? That's a pretty important decision that the voters will have a chance to vote in a special election coming up right around the corner.
Well, absolutely. And it looks like it's pretty much a 2-person race at this point. I know Hernandez and Grijalva are 2 names that have been around there for a long time. And I think the congressman's daughter is going to be very formidable. But Daniel's been able to raise quite a bit of money in the past, and that appears to be playing out again. So it'll be interesting to see. It's really just in these kinds of elections, it's just raising money very quickly and getting organized to get folks out to vote, because they're usually, as you know, special elections are just such low voter turnout, unfortunately. It's the organization that can get their base out. That's always critical. And I think her having her father, you know, had that seat for so long tends to be an advantage, I would think. But, you know, money and organization can trump that if they can get it done.
Hi, mean, this is Matt Neely. Just a question. The district really spans 3 media markets. Obviously, the Grijalva brand in Tucson is pretty strong. I know that there is part of it in Maricopa County and some in part of Yuma. Do you think that there are enough votes or enough brand awareness in those markets to carry Adelita through, or do you think Hernandez can make up some traction, especially in the Maricopa County market? Are there enough votes up there?
Well, you know, Matt, it's always that good campaigns always look at where can they mine votes. And if those precincts, even though there's not that many of them in Yuma and Maricopa, they tend to be high voter turnout, then you bet they're going to be engaging in those areas. Because if they feel that they can, even though they might be a low number of voters, but if they're high propensity voters, then they're going to go after them, and they're going to go after them very hard. But it really depends on that kind of data that sophisticated campaigns nowadays really look at. They'll track down those votes. When people request early ballots, the campaigns with resources and organizations will also chase those ballots because they know who took them out. And so knowing that, that's why folks that are high propensity voters and do a lot of early ballot voting, those are the ones that are getting 15, 20, postcards a day or mailers a day, and then telephone calls and all those things. But it's really based on that information, on them trying to figure that out. But certainly if there's votes to be had and they think the media can help them, that's going to be a big part of their game plan.
Well, and that's where having a good war chest comes in, because you need funding to be able to chase those ballots. So it will be interesting. I don't do math in public, but just based on the numbers, I think this thing will pretty much be over in the primary. And that's, folks will get a chance to vote in the general with a number of Republican candidates in that race as well. But I just don't see a path forward for any of those candidates on the Republican side, just based on voter registration.
Oh, absolutely. And this is one of those rare seats that whomever wins will likely be a congressperson from that district for the next maybe 20 to 30 years. Mm-hmm. Because just for that reason, unless they mess up or decide to run for another seat, Senator Gallego did. I mean, he was in a very safe seat on the west side of Maricopa County. Would have had that congressional seat for as long as he wanted. But then an opportunity came to run for the United States Senate, and he took it. So I would anticipate the same thing happening here. Whomever wins will be very secure for a long, long time.
Jaime, I got a little bit of mental whiplash this week. Governor Hobbs vetoed a bill that would prohibit China from buying land in our state, and then a couple of days later came back with her own ban act that would prohibit China from buying land in our state. What am I missing? Or is this just come back to politics and ego all over again?
Yeah, I think it comes back to full circle. So just on that point, and I can't remember the exact bill number, but Warren Peterson, the Senate president, had said when the Senate comes back that they want to introduce an override. And so you need 2/3 of the legislature, and certainly they would need Democrat votes to join the Republicans in overriding the governor's veto. Because this is so politically charged that, we're not doing anything to protect our military installations. Mm-hmm. There are a number of Democrats that they face political backlash if they don't do something. So I think it prompted the governor, knowing that there is a real fear of possibly Democrats turning Republicans, for her to come out with her own plan to say, hey, don't worry about it. We're taking care of it. We don't need this legislation.
Well, and in fairness to the governor, her position is, despite what people might interpret, her position was the original bill did not go far enough to protect our interests. And I just some quick research. It was on the internet, Jaime, so it must be true. Mm-hmm. Chinese interests own 294,000 acres in Maricopa and Pinal counties. That's a chunk.
Yeah. That is. And I don't know what's the real number or if that's smaller than what it could be, but there certainly is a reason for us to have some safeguards, especially around our military installations. There's no doubt about mm-hmm. that. And coming up with a reasonable approach, again, I'm not sure if the governor's just trying to protect herself politically, but certainly she had to do something. And I think being aggressive on this is going to help her, not just with this particular bill, but certainly in a year when this issue, I guarantee you, will come up again in debates and in mailers attacking Governor Hobbs. All of those things always come into play. And it goes back to my point. The reason why you have atrophy a lot of times is because they're already positioning for that 2026 election cycle. So that's a big part of these fights that we're having right now.
Jaime, we got just a couple minutes left before we have to take another break. I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us. Do you have a betting wagering pool for sine die?
It was funny. There used to be a pool. They stopped doing that, which I think is criminal because it was always fun. I used to, in all candor, and letting it out a secret here, but for years I would always put in the governor's name and I would always put in a very early date for sine die. And nobody ever knew who that was, but it was always fun doing that when they would say, well, Governor Ducey says they're going to be out in March. So unfortunately, we don't do that anymore.
And for,
I would say, yeah, in the next probably 2 weeks.
And for our listeners who don't know, sine die is Latin for without a day, but it references the adjournment of the legislative session with the date to reconvene in the future.
Correct. And hopefully we'll get done with the legislative session for this year.
Outstanding. Well, Jaime, we really appreciate your time with us and look forward to having you back here on the Morning Voice sometime soon.
Ben, Matt, it's always a pleasure to be on with you both.
It's a privilege, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, Jaime Moleta, founder and partner of Moleta Alvarez. This is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for the vacationing Ted Maxwell with Matt Neely behind the glass here. And Matt knew, you knew what sine die meant, right, Matt?
Without further business or something like that.
Or something like that. Boy, your Latin is outstanding. Ladies and gentlemen.
2 years, baby.
There you go. If you have a question, give us a call, 790-2040. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is BBG, Ben Bueller Garcia, sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We're talking about civic engagement today here on 1030 The Voice, your local source for trusted local news and talk. And just an amazing lineup this morning, Matt. I can't believe what Ted's put together.
Wow,
and
I
just get to drop in and do it, right? Be the dancing chicken. But we're very pleased to be joined now by the Arizona Treasurer, Kimberly Yee. Kimberly, welcome to the Morning Voice. What a pleasure.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
Kimberly, you, if I'm not mistaken, you are the only statewide elected Republican. And not only that, but I mean, you absolutely just crushed it in your last race.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It was not even close.
Thank you. Well, I am the highest ranking statewide Republican in Arizona, and I worked really hard to earn every vote. In the 2022 cycle, I was up for re-election for state treasurer, and it really was a blessing for me because not only do I love this office, but I was able to talk to every single county in Arizona. I reached out to groups that had never been reached out to before, and you saw that in the numbers. And I'm proud of the numbers, but I also think it's important because we're a state that is not only growing, but we really need to engage in so many different communities that I think we have not in the past. And it's important to have everybody's voice at the table.
You're right, Kimberly, it's always been my perspective. I mean, you're not exactly your seat is not a down ballot thing, but I suspect most Arizona voters look at their ballot and see treasurer, and they've got no idea what your job is and how important it is. It's got to be one of the lesser understood statewide offices out there.
Exactly. And I wanted to ensure that when I became treasurer, people really got to know what the office was, because this is their office. This is the people's government. And so we immediately started changing how we market what we do in a way that's meaningful to people, so that we would put a lot more on social media. I readjusted how we really communicated so that we do a lot more with less words and less in terms of the intimidation factor for many people who might not really understand a lot of this investment stuff that we do in our office. But just to give you an example, we manage $64.7 billion in the taxpayer funds that come in and out of the cash flow through our office. Most people wouldn't know that. And that's significant because it touches every taxpayer, whether it's at the local municipal level, to the state agencies, to even school districts. And so it's important to really engage people and help them understand not only what my office does from the treasurer's perspective, but also how it touches them and how they can engage. So we've added a lot of elements that really help the average family. I can share a couple with you. We added financial literacy, for instance, as an element that is a responsibility of the office. So I went to the legislature and I asked them, in the role and responsibility as the state treasurer, can you now make advancing the awareness of money management a role of the Arizona State Treasurer, so that when I'm gone and my passion, you know, leaves with that term, I want to make sure that future treasurers also really take a look at how we can help families understand money management, because there's a direct correlation between how an individual and a family manages their money to the greater fiscal health of the state of Arizona. And so if we can help on both ends, you know, that's really our job.
Well, you've done a great job. Now, it's been quite a few years since my fifth grade civics classes. I don't know if we even teach civics in school anymore, but I hope we do. But you don't set the budget. It's your job to manage the budget and the financial resources and assets for the state taxpayers and to do a good job at that. And I saw something, Kimberly, you increased the assets under management by 105%. That's good. I mean, if you were my stockbroker, I'd take that every day of the week.
I started with $15.4 billion in assets under management, and today we sit at $31.7 billion. So we have more than doubled, obviously, that amount, and that means more money for Arizonans. So just the basics of my office is the legislature, they, with the governor, determine the budget every single fiscal year. And as the money comes over, I'm like the state's banker. So I distribute that money to those recipients that are determined based on that budget. And so just like any other banker, your local banker, you get your money out, you withdraw. But I also invest the funds. And that's the most important part, is that we're always making sure that we're investing in a safe way, because these are taxpayer dollars. So my philosophy is safety before liquidity, before yield. And we invest on U.S.-only based companies to ensure that the money goes right back to the taxpayer, but it's more money on the money. And so that shows you that by over 105% increase in the time I've served as the treasurer, it really has been very successful. But we've also added more money to our local government. So one of the things that we do is we invest funds for local cities and towns and tribal governments and any taxing jurisdiction. But one of the things I noted right off the bat was we've got to get in every single county. And so I'm traveling all over the state, and I'm talking about how we can invest local government money better, because as they pool their funds together, that means greater returns, right? It's simple math. So we've increased that pool by these various visits across the state. And we have seen an enormous amount of growth in the local government investment pool by over 145%. And so that means more money, again, to our local government so that they can do more with those funds, from transportation, education, infrastructure, so much. And so we're really happy about that growth as well.
Kimberly, one of the things I hear so often locally, and I don't know how accurate it is or not, or if somebody's just looking for a boogeyman out there, at least here in Southern Arizona, a lot of the electeds are blaming the flat tax for their own precarious financial situations. Is that an accurate summation or not?
No, I believe that there has been added spending that has created the decrease. So when revenues aren't coming in at the same pace, for whatever reason, whether it's inflation, the market volatility we see, then and people who are making those decisions are spending at a higher rate, that math doesn't work out. And so, there's lots of people who can blame whatever it is. But on my side, I get to see the money coming in and the money going out. And it's very clear to me that the spending has gone up.
It's always been my suspicion, because there was, during the pandemic, the money flowing out of Washington just was, the spigot just did not seem to shut off. And my perspective, Kimberly, is some of the local elected bodies then created programs with what were supposed to be one-time funds, and then now they're expecting them to continue in perpetuity. I mean, my example is, that's like if I won, $1 million in the state lottery and then expected that I put that on my income line every year after that. Life just doesn't work that way.
Right, exactly. And people get used to that money. So it's never going to be temporary. And then there's always the excuse right before it expires, oh no, there's going to be a cliff, and then everybody panics, and then they add more money for another 10 years. It's just, it's not wise. I always liken it to the fact that we have term limits and people always want to get reelected, right? So they don't necessarily look 10, 15, 20 years out from a budgeting perspective. They look to their next term to see what they can bring back for their next vote and reelection. And it's unfortunate, but that's how it goes, not only on the legislative branch, but as you can see at the federal level as well.
One of the topics that's come up this morning with some of our other guests, Kimberly, is the overspending by the executive branch, by the governor's office, a significant amount of money. As the treasurer, do you have the authority to be the adult in the room and cut off their credit cards, or do you just have to kind of bite your lip and see how it goes?
I don't, because I have my own, executive branch agency. And so the governor, in her mismanagement of spending, as we saw in this last legislative session, asked for the legislature to reimburse her for over $100 million of an expenditure that was never approved by the Arizona legislature. And so they were really in a bind. And what ended up happening, I believe, was that and I wrote a letter, you can see it on my website, to the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, that you really cannot continue with this funny business of mismanagement at that gross level, gross fiscal mismanagement at the executive. And it really needs to be accounted for, because these are taxpayer dollars. You can't just say, oops, you did it again. Yeah. And then you replenish those funds again with reimbursements from some other fund. That's just not responsible budgeting. You have to put your foot down. And so, yes, the answer is I do make it known where I stand when they do this type of mismanagement of budget at the Hobbs executive level. But I also call on my, legislative colleagues, former legislative colleagues at the state capitol, and let them know, you do have the ability to just say no.
Okay.
And so what they chose in this round was that they were able to pay back the reimbursements as requested by Hobbs, but they took money from somewhere else to do it. So is that fair to those other entities that decrease their funding because of the other mismanagement that happened on the other side?
My vote is no.
Exactly. Well, you should run for the legislature, Ben.
No, don't get me started. So, Kimberly, when we come back, I want to chat with something that's, I know, near and dear to both of our hearts. Prop 123's expiration is coming up, and I know education is very important to you as well. So when we come back, if you don't mind, I'd like to chat about that. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, we talked about politics being local. There is a Republican CD7 candidate forum coming up on July 14th, 1145 East Fort Lowell Road. The three Republican candidates, Gutierrez, Ramirez, and Rivas, will be there. Doors open at 9:30, events at 10:30, and it's being moderated by our very own host here, Charles Heller. Please check that out and get engaged in community. This is Ben Buehler-Garcia with Matt Neely. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is your guest host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, Matt Neely behind the glass, trying to keep us between the lines. He's doing it pretty good today, and I'm not easy to work with. I know that, Matt. Thank you very much. We're honored to be talking with the highest Republican elected official in the great Grand Canyon State, Arizona Treasurer Kimberly Yee. Kimberly, I know, if I'm not mistaken, along your career path, you actually spent some time working with Governor Schwarzenegger from California on, I think you're involved in some education issues. So I'm guessing that's pretty important to you.
Oh, it is. I actually started my early career completely in K-12 public school policy, as well as higher education. I went to Pepperdine University, but I'm born and raised here in Arizona, and Pepperdine's just the next state over. So I worked for two Republican governors in that state, Governor Pete Wilson in the 1990s and later Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. And in between, I worked for the Arizona State Senate Education Committee as their lead research analyst that, provides all of the data to the committee before they vote. So I absolutely have that knowledge and skill for what we have done in the great state of Arizona on education and just where we have gone in terms of charter schools, the ability for students to have really strong academic standards. So that was certainly part of my early history before I went to the legislature. And then, of course, I served as the chair of the Education Committee in the State Senate.
And so you actually, Kimberly, worked with Republican governors from California before they became an endangered species.
Absolutely. I think that was the last one. And I don't know that we'll see it again, unfortunately. And, California's changed so dramatically. It obviously has a lot of problems, and it has a lot to do with the leaders that they elect. That's why we see so many Californians fleeing to our great state of Arizona, because we have the freedoms that they never get to see over there.
Kimberly, on my dad's side of the family, everybody were farmers. And, it's in the importance of putting in the next crop. You always have to be thinking way down the line. And I feel that way about education in our community. If we're not educating the next generation, we're doing everyone a disservice. It's like, allowing a cavity to just develop and grow. Prop 123, mm-hmm. which is approved by the voters several years ago, is expiring June 30th, literally. And everything I'm getting from the other guests we've had on the show is that renewal of that is just not in the cards this year. But we're talking what, $300 million, that's going to fall to you. Excuse me. You're going to have to make up that shortage out of the general fund.
It's going to be, yes, it's going to be paid, and there are already plans for that money to go out to our schools, no matter what they decide to do. And if they choose not to do anything this year, there will not be any pause in the payments. So we're ready to go. Either way, it does look like they may have a pause this year and not make a decision until next year. And if that's the case, the schools are still going to see those dollars come into their schools without any delay.
But how long can this go on? What if they pause again next year? Is that going to start having to come out of the general fund every year, or is there some other kind of sunset attached to the original proposition?
There was a sunset of 10 years, and so that expiration would have been this year. But because the manner in which they, you know, can put that same amount of money that is given to schools into a budget passed by the legislature, it's incorporated, so there is still flow of funds. However, distribution rates are really where we're talking about. So Proposition 123 10 years ago changed the distribution rate from roughly 2.5%, which it was for a very long period of time, to 6.9%. And 10 years ago, there was an education lawsuit that was, trying to be settled. There were a lot of action, you know, that they were trying to determine based on the fund, based on the amounts that needed to go back to the schools on that settlement. And so we've been at 6.9% for about 10 years. And if you take a look at the industry norm in an endowment like ours is a state land endowment, which means anytime you have state land across Arizona that is sold by the Arizona Land Department, the proceeds of those sales come to the Arizona Treasurer's Office, and my great investment team manages those funds in an investment that goes back to 13 beneficiaries that were outlined in the Constitution. The K-12 public schools is the largest of the beneficiaries. 93% of total Prop 123 funds goes back to school. So this is a significant discussion when we're talking about education. Well, and roughly, you mentioned, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say we're unfortunately running out of time, Kimberly, but as an Arizonan, I'm just very grateful and proud that we've got someone like you down there looking after our assets and managing these things. I think there's so much, and that's the reason we do this show. There's so much there that people don't understand, and I think a lot of folks don't really get what the state land trust fund does and what a tremendous asset that is for our community. So I appreciate you keeping things between the line. Just real quick, 30 seconds, Kimberly, what's your Reader's Digest version on the financial status of our state? Strong, moderate, in trouble?
Oh, we're doing well, and we should be proud of that. We have to keep our businesses open. We have to keep continuing to deregulate those laws so that we have the ability to have businesses do what they want to do on the ground with great freedom. It's the free enterprise market, so we want to keep that strong.
Outstanding. Kimberly, thank you so much for spending time with our listeners today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bueller Garcia, it's been a real privilege sitting in here for Ted Maxwell. Matt, thanks for sticking around with us. Don't forget, we continue your local news and talk with Wynn Tucson coming up right here next on KVOI. Stick around.
Yeah, and Wynn Tucson, they're going to be speaking a border discussion with Nicholas Quetz, the father of Doug Quetz. Stick around, should be very interesting.